Everyone, and welcome to episode 9 of season 3 of Movie Route Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action movie Die Hard, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Tyler Howitt of the Couch Potato Philosophy Podcast. Welcome back, Tyler.
Thanks for having me.
Always been fun. I've been having a fun time this week. Hopefully you have too. Yeah, we'll start off with a little music and, start off with a little music and then get to see the grandeur of the outside of the Nakatomi building. How's that?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Right. So minute 9 begins with the Christmas music by Run DMC continuing and ends with McClane walking towards the front door of a large skyscraper. So yesterday we ended the minute talking about the music by Run DMC. It continues into this minute. You know, a lot of the lyrics that you mentioned yesterday appear today also. Yep. You know, we the whole time it gives us a steady shot of Nakatomi in the distance. You know, and then we see the limo enter the parking area in front of the building, which is completely deserted. You know, it's huge. It's huge. It's this amazingly large, you know, circular area, but it's just completely empty.
it is. And in fact, even with their drive, I mean, there are other cars on the highway as they're driving up, but it definitely just the whole day feels deserted. It's just them. And again, I feel like that goes with this impending, you know, it's just John. It's just Argyle headed toward this spot that's going to be so pivotal for the movie. And I think that's important. I think it's really important. And I even wanted to, I'm going to talk about the light in the next episode, I think. But yeah, right. This is, but we do get this. Just it's this hazy LA is what we get that they're driving through, and this silhouetted, almost silhouetted tower is looming over them.
Right. That's true. But I mean, basically, I love the fact that we can see towards the entrance, there's this like large emblem of Nakatomi. You know, again, it shows how much they actually, you know, put into the production of this. Yes. Because it's just amazing that they would, you know, they would make this fake emblem to be sitting there for us to be able to, you know, to look at.
Yeah. And it's everywhere. I mean, really, it's all over the place when you start looking for it too. It's it's all over it was on the card. It's on I think it's above the elevators. It's all over the place in this film.
Yeah, for sure.
And it could have gone nondescript. It could have been just a nondescript building. Fine, it doesn't matter. But like you said, it is a character in the film in a lot of ways. And so I think giving that character that face, that identity is an important thing.
Yeah, and it works. There's no question about that. You know, so one of the things I wanted to look at was, I mean, we see that it's starting to get dark at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, so I wanted to look up at what time on December 24th, 1988, they actually had, sunset, and when was twilight and stuff like that. So what would be your guess? You know, when do you think we're obviously talking the first few days of winter. You know, so the shortest days. So what would you think?
Yeah. But in LA, which is a little further south, you want actual sunset, you think?
Yeah, sure.
Let's say 6:30.
It was at 4:50.
Jeez. Okay. So this is an afternoon flight.
Yeah.
And actually, you know what? This actually makes sense. If we're, even though you said it's a Saturday.
Yeah.
So weirdly, I've always thought this is I've always thought this was end of a work day, like on a Friday or something like that. But I guess maybe Saturday, they pulled Saturday as a work day because otherwise everybody's coming in for the office party.
Exactly. Well, Holly's the only one we've seen working and her secretary.
Yes.
You know, no one else is working.
Yeah.
I mean, Ellis, you can say he's working, but he's working something else. Yeah.
He's working something else. Yeah, he's working his angle. Yeah. Yeah, the only one I'm disappointed I haven't gotten to talk about is Ellis, because, man, but anyway. But that's it's because of his better line later on about him being a white knight. But
yeah.
I can't, when I watched all of Die Hard, I can't stop saying that line because I think it's a great one. But anyway, that's beside the point.
I must have missed that episode of 60 Minutes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Or the after school special. Yeah, I think I like, like I said, it's again, it all feels not heavy in a negative way, but like with the weight of importance that he's driving up, and he's the tower is looming over him, and he's kind of slowly walking in because it's not necessarily that he's about to fight a bunch of terrorists, but he's about to see his wife and it's about to be real and all this other stuff. And I like the heaviness that kind of comes with this as they drive up.
Right.
To the plaza.
Exactly. But I mean, for me, it shocks me that it, you know, that we're only talking, this is not even 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's had a full day of flight. It's not even five in the afternoon. And the thing that's more shocking, since you mentioned that it's on a Saturday.
Yeah.
So,
but they had to make it work. Come on. What can you do?
Yeah, it's got to work. It's got to be there. Yeah.
Yeah. They couldn't say, oh, this happens the day after. No, but also I would think that most places would have a Christmas party not on Christmas Eve.
Yeah, that's another one. Unless weirdly it fell on.
Is it a work is it day possible that like this that. Is Friday night? This is not the 24th.
That I would say that's how I've always read it. And we know for sure it's the 24th. Like we definitely know it's
we don't. It's never mentioned.
Okay. Okay. I wasn't sure. So I would read it as it's a work day and it's right after a work day. That's because that's the only way it makes sense. They're not coming in on Christmas Eve at 5 o'clock for a party. That's weird to me.
Yeah, so it makes more sense that it would probably be on Friday night.
Yeah. Yeah, if Christmas is on Sunday, you have your party on Friday night. It's probably what you do.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. Because also, like, why would he fly in only on Christmas?
Yeah, right?
Yeah, you'd think that he would have turned up the day before.
Yeah, he's a cop. He can take a couple days for Christmas to go visit his family. I think he's... Yeah, I'm reading that as Friday. It's a Friday.
Yeah, I think you might be right about that one. I've been, you know, I think at some point I remember it saying that it is Christmas Eve. So that
I kind of assumed it was. Yeah.
I don't know. I'll have to check into this. You know, there's something a little fishy here, because again, I think I have heard that it does take place on Christmas Eve. But when we're thinking about it, doesn't
for sure, isn't it?
No, Die Hard 2 also can.
I thought it was.
No, because again, what you know, he's in Die Hard 2. He's suggesting to Holly that they're gonna, you know, go rent a car and go to a motel on Christmas Eve.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, it wouldn't be. That's a good point. It feels like it is more because of the snow, I think. But let's see here. It's. Two or three things that I've just randomly typed up say set on Christmas Eve about Die Hard.
Right.
But I wonder if that's an assumption.
Correct. And I think if that is the assumption that we've all made, I think it's an incorrect assumption. I think it makes a lot more sense that this is Friday night.
Yeah.
As opposed to it being Saturday night. Yeah. Me too.
Yeah. But,
we'll have to see as this goes through if there are more hints either way.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder if there's a calendar on somebody's desk or something.
No, because I know that you know, Argyle's last line is, if this is Christmas, I can't wait to be here for New Year's. But
yeah,
you know, but he could be just referring to the fact that if this is it's Christmas time, you know,
he doesn't
specifically have to be, you know, Christmas Eve at the time. Right. So then we get the screenplay credits for Jeb Stuart and Stephen E. D'Souza.
With some big names to their credits, yeah.
But most of them are after this. aren't they?
Yes. Jeb Stuart, this was his first credit. And then Stephen E. D'Souza had written 48 Hours and Command. I mean, he'd written 7 beforehand, including 48 Hours, Commando, The Running Man. And then he would also write Die Hard 2. But quite a few good ones after the fact. And also, wow, actually, now that I see this, also, he wrote Lara Croft 2 Tomb Raider, The Cradle of Life.
I guess he was working with John DeVant.
He was working with John DeVant, yeah. Jeb Stuart.
He wrote The Fugitive.
He wrote The Fugitive, which I love.
I do too.
That's a great film. Another 48 Hours, and he is the showrunner of the new Vikings Valhalla.
Ooh, interesting.
Yeah, after not having done anything for 12 years, it looks like.
I think after writing Die Hard and The Fugitive, you want to stop.
You don't need to. Yeah, you don't need to work.
No, it's not a question you don't need to work. You don't want to work because you don't want.
Yeah, fair.
You want to make sure that people won't say, oh, you know, look at M. Night Shyamalan. If he would have stopped after his first two or three movies, he would be gold.
He would be gold. Yeah. You know, unfortunately.
Which is one of the reasons why Tarantino keeps saying that he's stopping after 10, because he wants, you know, he doesn't want to reach the point where people will say, oh, this is a one hit wonder type of guy. And then we get the producer credits for Lawrence Gordon and Joel Silver. Obviously.
And I recognize Joel Silver, but I did not recognize Lawrence Gordon's name. And maybe that's just, I just didn't recognize it for some reason. But Joel Silver, I mean, you can't spit almost without hitting a Joel Silver movie. He's just, Predator, Lethal Weapon, 48 Hours, Predator 2, Die Hard 2, Lethal Weapon 2. I mean, just, he's
The Matrix.
He's
on him.
The Matrix, V for Vendetta, let's see what else. Sherlock Holmes. Now, I will say the last 10 years, not so much with the strong films.
Right. But again, if you look at what he did through the 80s and 90s, that's where.
Yeah, he's doing fine.
Yeah. You know, he produced Roadhouse also. Shout out to. Shout out to Roger and Marcy about that one. You know, they have their Movies by Minute podcast on Roadhouse.
Yep.
He did Brewster's Millions too. I love that movie. It's such a fun movie with Richard Pryor and John Candy.
That one I haven't seen. Have not seen it.
Yeah. Okay. It's about a guy. It's about a guy who will inherit $300 million if within 1 month he can spend $30 million and not have a single cent left at the end of that month.
Oh wow. That's actually
something. He's not allowed to have any possessions either. So you can't like just buy something and then have it.
Oh, sure.
Whatever you buy, you cannot have afterwards.
Wow. That's actually great.
And he can't give, he's got all these rules. He can't like give it away and stuff like that. You know, it's a really fun movie. Yeah. Huh. It's relatively stupid, but it's still fun.
That sounds fun. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And then we get the credit for the director, John McTiernan, who we discussed in length last week, especially about his criminal activity and, you know, how he sat in jail for wiretapping both a fellow producer and also his ex-wife.
Yeah, I don't know too much. I know the overview, but I know that that one's unfortunate.
Yeah, completely. It happened in 2003, but he didn't go to prison until like 2013 or 2014. It took a long time because he was constantly in court throughout all those years.
Gotcha.
Yeah, you know, he became a persona non grata in Hollywood during that time. Obviously,
I bet. Is he in prison still? Oh, he's only
in prison. No. He was only in for like a year, and he even spent a few of them in under house arrest. You know, a few months under house arrest. And then we see the limo pull up near the entrance. Now, what I find really funny is that I mean, obviously we know Argyle is not much of a driver, but he parks atrociously.
He does. You know, it's just like
there's no cars around it. Exactly.
No,
there are no cars around
so
there
bad.
At all. And he the way he parks is just pretty funny. And then we see you know, a shot of John getting out of the limo. And then the two of them begin to have another conversation.
Yeah.
So, you know, Argyle says to him, "So your lady sees you, you run into each other's arms, the music comes up, and you live happily ever after, right?" And then John goes, "I can live with that." Now, okay, I want to mention about these two things. First of all, you know, the fact that he says, "I can live with that," that doesn't, he's not too enthusiastic about it. You know, it's, you know, you'd think that he would be, if he really wanted his marriage to work, he would be much more enthusiastic.
Yeah.
Right.
I know you definitely get the sense that he's bitter about it. I think he blames her for leaving. But also is, I also wonder how much of this is, how much of this is just Bruce Willis cool, you know, it, or is the, he's supposed to just be playing it cool the entire time along with that, you know, "You're very fast, Argyle." He's not an enthusiastic guy until later. We see enthusiastic him toward the end, but I think right now he's playing cool cop guy. And I think it works.
Yeah. So I wanted to look up the idea of happily ever after.
Yeah.
And you know, like, where does that notion come from? So basically it's a plot. It's an ending used in plots of fiction where almost everything turns out for the best for the main protagonists and their sidekicks, while obviously the villains or the antagonists are completely defeated.
Yep.
Right. So what's very funny is that, you know, the definition of happily ever after only refers to the main characters. So, There's a famous quote from Roger Ebert in one of his reviews of the movie The Day After Tomorrow, which was a post-apocalypse type of movie after a storm. It was a fun movie. You know, I'm a Dennis Quaid fan, so I liked it. But so basically, he starts off by saying, "Okay, billions of people have died, but at least the major characters have survived." You know. So that can be considered a happy ending type of, you know, a movie with a happy ending.
Yeah. Well, it goes back to the old Greek notion of a comedy, right? Where it starts badly, but ends well. But it still only ends well for the main few characters. Usually there's some bad guy who's gotten his comeuppance and he's, you know, left to he's in jail or he's dead or something like that. But the main characters got married, so we're fine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. So it says here the definition is a happily ever after ending only requires that the main characters be all right. Millions of innocent background characters can die, but as long as the characters that the reader, viewer, audience cares about survive.
Absolutely. Yep.
So I just find it funny that's what Argyle's, you know, points to here. And then, you know, then he gives the flip side and he goes, "So if that doesn't work out, man, you got a place to stay?" And then John's response is, "I'll find a place." And then he comes up with a you know, first of all, Argyle is a little overly friendly. I mean, earlier this week we were talking about him, you know, he's trying to find him some sort of girl to hook up with. And now he's looking for, he's you know, about to tell him that you know, he's willing to find a place for him to stay and stuff like that. You know, so, I mean, Argyle says, "I tell you what, I'm going to pull into the parking garage and I'll wait. You score, you give me a call on the car phone, and I'll take your bags to the desk. You strike out, I'll get you a hotel." So he's definitely overstepping his bounds here. I mean, we need him for this. There's no question about it. There's a reason why this character is going to be sticking around.
Yeah.
You know, and the irony is they might not have known when they first wrote it why he's sticking around. Because the part of the ending was something that was only thought of as they were in the middle of filming. So I wonder what they really thought. Because we'll see in a few weeks when they showed the truck, you don't see the ambulance in the back of the truck. That wasn't there.
Oh, okay.
They add that later on.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I wonder if he was just intended to be this comic relief that we just keep flipping back to, maybe.
Right, it could be.
Yeah. I really like this offer from Argyle. I think it's despite the fact that it's so weird and it's who offers that. But it also is strange too, that, when John is talking to Holly, he says, when John is talking to Holly, he says, "Oh, I'll just go stay with the cap." He's off in Ramona, and she corrects him and says Pomona. And so he actually does have an idea of what to do. He doesn't let Argyle in on it, because why is he going to let Argyle know, you know, he's got, he does have another option.
But, right. That's true. No, but it's also, I mean, you know, is Argyle in the clock here? How does that work? You know, is,
oh yeah.
You know, is that why he's not offering it?
Later he, yeah.
No,
especially later, when he's talking to his girlfriend, he's like, "Oh, my boss thinks I'm on the way to Vegas."
Yeah,
or whatever.
Vegas, right. Exactly.
Is he supposed to be on the clock? And does he have another drive?
Yeah,
that we don't know about.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if limo drivers like this get paid by the hour, or if it's they get paid for the job, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Really don't know. And so John looks at him, smiles, and says, "You're all right, Argyle." And Argyle responds, "Just remember that when you sign for the tip."
I did like that too, where Nakatomi is for sure the ones paying him. John, I hope John was going to give him a big old tip after that, because it's not out of his wallet. But
right.
But again, would John do that as a New York cop who's got some pride? I don't know.
Don't know. Not really sure. And then when McLean starts walking towards the front door, and that's pretty much how this minute ends.
Yep.
Yeah. So did you have anything else you wanted to mention about in this minute?
No, I'll talk a little bit more. Yeah. With the next one, I've got some things to say in the next one.
All right, great. So there are a few differences in the script. It says that Argyle actually gets out of the car and McLean lets himself out, which is fine because it says here, McLean lets himself out, which is fine because Argyle doesn't remember he's supposed to do it. You know, because usually in a limo, the driver's supposed to open the door for you.
Yep.
And then says they both go to the rear of the vehicle. And then Argyle says his line about the music, you know, happily ever after. And then McLean goes, "It's corny, but I could live with it." You know.
That's nicer.
It's nicer, yes. Yes.
Yeah.
But again, he's
I think they're trying to play Bruce Willis very cool, is all it is.
But he needs to be more enthusiastic about his marriage.
Oh, I agree.
Right. And then the final line of the minute where he says, "Just remember that when you sign for the tip," he then points to the building and says, "They're paying for it, so don't be shy."
See, it's what I said. Yeah, they're paying for it. Yeah,
exactly. So the novel has a few other discrepancies here with how things work out. So basically, the driver says to him, "Mr. Leland, you go in the front and I'll take your luggage down to the garage to Miss Gennaro's car. Tell her the keys will be tucked under the front seat. She knows, and you have yourself a Merry Christmas." All right. So I like the fact that they changed it there. You know, it gives us a reason why he's going down into the, you know, that instead of John having to carry his luggage across. So basically, you know, he's going to just put it in his daughter's car.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so there is something to that, the way that they add that to that. And that's the main thing that I liked about the way they added it here in the novel itself. And then
it definitely changes the dynamic for sure.
Yeah. For sure. And this will be the last we're going to hear of this cab driver for a while in the novel, but I believe he'll be back if I remember correctly. It's been years since I read it, but now I'm just reading it, you know, week by week. So that I'm not giving myself too much, you know, too much spoilers ahead. You know, I'm waiting to see how things play out.
I'm going to pick up the book. I've always thought about reading it, but I never have.
There you go. All right. So every Thursday we do a segment called Off the Beaten Track, Holiday Edition. And so Tyler, you have another story to tell us.
I do. Well, this one's actually pretty recent, and it's just a series of unfortunate events is more the way I would describe it. This was actually this Christmas we were trying to. So I live in Central Washington. My parents live in Northern California, and my wife and I were driving down to go there for Christmas, and we got there. It's great. this was a crazy winter. We got insane snows. We had in early January, we had a 4-foot snow. I mean, the entire city got shut down, just got buried into our driveway. But we were hitting snowstorms like crazy, on the way back from California up to Washington. And so, we had to time it. We were going to stay a few days longer, I think through the 29th of December. But we had to leave earlier. We left on the 27th or something like that, because we just saw there's this crazy amount of snow, and we kind of threaded the needle between two storms that was going with us as we were driving north. And we kind of got dogged all the way by these storms, but then we get stuck by none other than a tree limb across the road, up at the top of a mountain, for a few hours, just sitting on top of a mountain with everybody else. This huge traffic jam. I don't think it hit anything. I don't think anybody got hurt, but we were really proud of ourselves for threading this storm needle basically on the way up, and then suddenly get stopped on the top, literally at the summit of a mountain. The summit sign was right parallel with our car. I think it was only, I don't know, a few thousand feet up. It's not like we were at the top of a Rocky Mountain or something, but just sitting up there, and we had been rushing and running all day, and kind of just had to say, okay, well, we're turning the car off. And we had just gotten food, and so we had food, we had water, and we had some coffee, and we just kind of sat and read and listened to some podcasts, and we had weirdly a kind of peaceful, jolly time up at the top of this mountain as we're waiting to see if emergency crews are going to clear the tree. So, it was just a fun time at the top of the mountain waiting for craziness to happen. But I remember thinking while we were sitting up there, this is a horror movie scene right here, right? It could be, the cars are all there and the slasher comes through and starts taking his time. So maybe I'll write that movie one day.
Wow. Okay. Sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Excellent. So do you want to once again tell everyone how they can get in touch with you?
Yep. You can find me on Twitter at Tyler Howitt. You can find me on Facebook as well, and Instagram with the same handle there. And the Couch Potato Philosophy Podcast, you'll be able to find us if you just search for us on Instagram and Twitter.
All right. While you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe on any podcast you're using to listen to this show. And you can just do a quick search and find Movie Rob Minute on Facebook, on Twitter, or you can go to our website. So, Tyler, you feel like coming back in tomorrow to finishing off the week?
Oh, I'll be here. One more minute to go.
There's no Argyle. There's no Argyle.
But, I know. Yeah, it's almost not worth talking about it if it's not about Argyle, but that's okay. We'll be here.
So I should find another guest.
Yeah, but just call somebody else. They'll fill in for me.
All right. So until tomorrow, everyone. Yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.